Hi, I'm Marieke Nijkamp. I'm the writer of The Oracle Code, and you're listening to Spoil It Country.
Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick and Jeff. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com.
Citizens of the Republic of Spoilervert, welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Kenneth Regan. That is Mr. Horsley. And today on the show, I'm going to do my best not to butcher her name. It's Marieke Nijkamp.
Yes, it is not Marikai Ninja Camp.
No, but no, it is not Marikai Ninja Camp. It's Marieke Nijkamp.
Yep.
I hope I got that right. I apologize if I did not. Please, Marieke, if you hear this, just go ahead and strangle me as much as you need to get it through my thick head.
Just know that we read one language very well, kind of, and we're not sure if that's English or not.
We're too typical. That's probably more the accurate answer.
Right.
Oracle Code.
But today, Jeff got to sit down and talk to her. Yeah, Oracle Code. Yeah, she the graphic novel out, Oracle Code, about Barbara Gordon after she gets the gun showing it's paralyzed from, you know, the classic story, The Killing Joke. And it's part of the new like mid-reader section DC's doing, right? They have Gotham High. They have Shadow of the Batgirl. They have Harley Quinn Breaking Glass. They have the Oracle Code. There's a ton of these out there. They're awesome.
Welcome, listeners of Spoiler Country. Today on the show, we have the incredible Marieke Nijkamp. How are we doing?
Pretty well, yeah.
How are things in the Netherlands right now?
I mean, weird. I think things are weird overall, like all over the world right now. But we're slowly easing out of lockdown, which is nice. Weird.
Well, I imagine things are a little bit better than they are on United States right now.
Yeah, for which I am obviously super grateful and very glad, and also looking at all of you with a sense of worry.
Well, we greatly appreciate that. It's probably well deserved at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, boy, it feels like science is pretty great, and we should just listen to science and do something with everything we know by now. But yeah, I really hope you're all doing well. And
yeah, yeah. Eventually we'll catch up to science. You know, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
We're a little slow. We're kind of a comparatively new country, but we have to science a few hundred years and the importance of it.
You'll get there eventually. I hope.
Well, speaking of science, I was looking at a little bit about your background, and it's really kind of cool. You have a degrees in philosophy and medieval studies.
Yep. Yeah, I decided I wanted to go for the things where I could obviously find a job in. No, I started a degree in philosophy immediately out of high school, and I think I was probably one of the only ones in my first year. Most of my fellow students were either people who went back to college after working for a couple of years or were doing a secondary degree or something like that. But I've always been super fascinated by just people and thought and how we look at the world, and especially how we look at the world like in a historical context, like how that's changed over time, how culture influences worldview and vice versa. So it just made a lot of sense to me at the time. I did a second degree in history, and specifically medieval history, because it's the most fascinating time. I specialize in European medieval history, and it's just I know what the movies tell you, and they're all wrong. Aside from A Knight's Tale. A Knight's Tale is fantastic, and I'll hear no arguments about that.
That was a very good movie. So how are they wrong then? So just for educate our readers. You don't have to go for an hour, but the key point.
I could easily go for an hour. I think one of the things that annoys me most is the idea that for like this period of 1,000 years, nothing happened or nothing changed, and people were pretty ignorant and didn't care about science and didn't care about like themselves or hygiene or whatever. And like, that's just factually wrong. People did actually care about science. There was a thriving, especially in like 11th century onwards, but like 12th century, 13th century, there was a thriving university culture in medieval Europe, for the most part, thanks to the fact that Jewish and Muslim scientists kept a lot of things that we sort of lost after the Roman Empire. So we couldn't have science now if it wasn't for like multicultural exchange and the exchange of thoughts. And people obviously knew that the Earth isn't flat. Like, for all the fact that we look at medieval maps now and think like they thought there were dragons there and they thought people would just fall off the earth. Like, that's not the case. There was people thought about the world the way we do now, which is through stories and things that they didn't know were described as dangerous. Like, that's the whole here be dragons. This is a part of the world where we've never been, so we don't know what to expect. So be careful. And like, to me, that's one of the most fascinating things about history in general, but specifically medieval history, like the way we relate to the world through storytelling and through interpreting what we see around us and can't necessarily explain. And like, people back then were like people right now. They cared about themselves. They cared about the people around them. They cared about their position, their place in the world, and wanted to make the best of it. And I think we occasionally forget that. Like, people who lived 500 years ago or 100 years ago or like 2,000 years ago or much further than that were also just people. And they thought of themselves as modern as we think of ourselves now.
So, I mean, do you see that a complete through line? Because you mentioned the idea of stories between medieval periods and their stories, like King Arthur. I don't know if Ivanhoe was in that same period. And then moving directly to comic books and what we're doing nowadays, like in philosophy as well, before that, with the stories written by Plato and Socrates, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a direct line in your opinion?
I mean, I think there's absolutely a direct line in the sense that we have always looked to stories to tell us about who we are and like the meaning of life and all these like nebulous concepts of like what it means to be human. And I think like, obviously we have this fantastic rich culture right now with all kinds of mediums of storytelling. But the fact that we have comic books right now, obviously, which is fantastic. Also, I came to comic books through Prince Valiant. So there's definitely a direct through line from like medieval-esque stories to my comic book writing. But this whole concept of like images and words and recounting stories to each other, like that's as old as humanity is. And finding ourselves in stories is like, that's never changed throughout history.
So you would agree that comic books are kind of our modern mythology on some level, sort of like I said, the old days of King Arthur. Then, like, if you go further back, obviously you have Achilles and those stories that is in many ways our mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think what comic books right now do is what those stories did back then, which is show us a mirror of what it can mean to be human, what it can mean to be a hero, what it can mean to be feel different from the people around you or like try to find your place in the world. Yeah, I think that's on whatever scale it is. Like, mythology can be this grand, this is how the world was designed or created or whatever, and this is everything that's ever been. But it can also be this very direct conversation between you and I, or between like one reader to another, from looking at a story and going like, is this how you see the world too? And if so, can we talk about that? And if not, where do we differ? And what does that how does that influence our conversations and our way of being?
Well, I mean, and it's very cool, I think, that you went from reading about medieval history to writing young adult and becoming a New York Times bestselling writer to comic books. So tell me a little bit about that path of yours.
I mean, I've been writing all my life, basically. I started, when I was young. I think the very first time I can remember specifically picking up pen and paper and wanting to write a book with the aim of publication was when I was 10-ish, 10, 11.
Oh, nice.
So I've been at it for a while, and I read and wrote stories and books. I'm like making quotation marks and you can't see that obviously, but like the things that I assumed at that time were books. Looking back, there were far too few pages to actually count as a proper book, but you know. But yeah, I was writing all through like middle school, high school, college, and specifically had always had this connection with YA stories, because I love how young adult is. It's there's something so immediate about reading young adult books. It's so very much focused on life right now, whether it is contemporary or fantasy, but like being and figuring out who you are and figuring out your place in the world, and it dares to ask very bold questions in doing so. And it's something that also always appealed to me. So when I, after college, started like properly writing again, which is to say got more serious about like spending time on my manuscripts, which seeing as I was doing two degrees at the same time was getting slightly hard, because I had to write a lot of papers, and at some point your creative energy is just completely gone. But yeah, I went back to figuring out my own writing and figuring out like what are the types of stories I want to put out into the world, what are the types of stories I want to create. And a lot of those also had that same like feeling of who am I and who can I be, which is something I think most YA books explore in one way or another. So I basically just wrote a lot of manuscripts and got rejected a lot, and wrote more and got rejected more, until at some point I wrote the manuscript that would become my first book, This Is Where It Ends, which is a book about a school shooting. And it was, yeah, I mean, that book kind of jump-started my career in the sense that it hit the New York Times bestseller list, and it stayed on there for well over a year, which is absolutely ridiculous. And I mean this in the best way possible, but it's like I'm still pinching myself that it meant I got to do a whole lot of cool things in terms of both writing more YA books, but also editing a YA anthology. And at some point, DC came calling. I was like, would you like to write a YA graphic novel? And that was the point where I was like, yes, obviously, I would like that. Please. I'd be willing to pay you money to let me.
Well, be careful with that. But DC's on the line, so don't let them know you do it for free.
Well, I've already written it, so that kind of helps. But yeah, I mean, I occasionally still feel that way. Like it was such a dream come true to get that phone call, and like they reached out to me and was like, yes, obviously I want to do this. I've been, like I just mentioned, I read comic books for many, many years. I started out reading Prince Valiant, and I sort of first discovered European comics from there, because superhero comics actually didn't make it over to the Netherlands in quite that popular fashion, at least when I was growing up. They weren't easy to get. They weren't easy to get in libraries or comic book shops or whatever. So I read a lot of historical comics, which was definitely far for the course in European comics at that point. And then from there, and when the internet became a thing, learned about other types of comics and started reading manga, but also started reading American superhero comics and fell in love, basically. So yeah, when I got that call, I was like, I absolutely want to do this. I've never written a comic before. I've never written a graphic novel before. But I am so into this.
So what is your fascination with Barbara Gordon? I mean, when you were approached by DC, was it in their mind to do Oracle itself? Or was it, we want you to do a graphic novel, do what you want with it? Or was it specifically, to you said, I want Barbara Gordon?
I mean, the question specifically was, would you be interested in writing a Barbara Gordon as Oracle book, but with the like caveat that if I had other ideas, I wanted to do something else, they'd be open to discussing that too. But for me, it really wasn't a question, because I like threw out all these like writing adventures and college adventures. Like one of the through lines in my life is I am disabled. I have been basically my entire life. I have a nice collection of chronic illnesses and chronic pain and all that kind of fun stuff. So a good part of me growing up, and especially in teenage years, was learning to live with disability and learning to find a way of being who I wanted to be while also dealing with the fact that my body imposed certain limitations on me, but also the world itself wasn't always as accessible as I needed it to be.
Yeah.
So I had been talking about disability representation in YA and in fiction for quite some time at that point. And I think that probably influenced why they specifically asked me for Barbara Gordon, but also Babs is such a integral character to so many disabled readers, myself included. And she is someone who I never really saw myself in fiction growing up. But I was a disabled teen who spent most of my life on the internet and used the internet quite early on to find a sense of social life and to make lifelong friendships. People I met in my early days on the internet are still some of my closest friends now. And having this superhero in DC continuity who does what she does because she is disabled and she has all these like cool hacker abilities and knows her way around online and knows her way around through computer systems and also happens to love books. Like she is something I resonated with a lot and someone I could really see myself in. So it was never a question in my mind that I needed to write Barbara as Oracle specifically.
Yeah, I think that was the most interesting thing about reading the Oracle code is that you kind of bypass the Batman connection. There's a few nods to Batman in the story. I think there's a couple of dolls of Robin, few something of Batman a little bit in the background. I guess as nods, but you do bypass the Batman persona and the Batgirl persona. Was that because, is there a concern that Batman either overshadows her, Barbara Gordon, as a character, or is it that there's something, it kind of highlights her heroism when you put her away from, let's say, the costume versions?
I mean, I don't necessarily think he would overshadow her so much in the sense that I think everyone in the Bat family has their own strengths and weaknesses, and obviously Batman is Batman and there's no escaping that, but I think pretty much everyone in the Bat family can shine on their in their own unique way. But the truth is I'm not actually that interested in Batman as a character.
Okay.
So it never really even occurred to me to have him in this book. I wanted to write a book about Barbara learning to be Oracle and learning to be herself, I think, more than anything else. I love Oracle as a character. And one of the things I really wanted to read and to some extent needed to read was that transition from Babs's Batgirl to getting shot to becoming Oracle. And there's hints of it in continuity. There is the fantastic Oracle Year One Born of Hope that actually does go into that. But it doesn't really touch on, I almost say, like the more emotional side of the story. The whole, what does it mean to be, what does it mean to see your entire world change, to see your place in the world change, to lose everything that you held on to and that you thought was important to not just yourself, but to being being who you are, being able to be who you want to be. And there's this I felt like that was not something that was necessarily ever specifically explored in that transitional period of Barbara's life. And it's something I knew really well because I'd been there. And obviously I've never thankfully been there because of a gunshot injury or anything like that. But I've learned to live with disability. I've learned to live with chronic illness and my body changing on me in ways that I hated and really struggled with finding my place again. And I wanted to explore that because I had talked to so many disabled teens and I knew how important it would be to them to see that too and to see that sense of recognition, to have this character who goes through it and is allowed to have all these hard emotions. She's allowed to be angry. She's allowed to be sad and confused. And she gets through it and finds herself again. And that's something I just really wanted to explore far more than what a Batman would do in a story like that, or what if her having a Batgirl history at that point would change anything. I don't think it would, because she's still fundamentally the same person. So for me, it was Oracle, because Oracle matters so incredibly much.
Now, I think what wonderful thing, because I did get to read the Oracle, and I thought one of the most fascinating things about it is that the character of Barbara Gordon, the way you wrote her, is so layered. She feels very real, and someone, like, you can feel her anger when she first reaches the ACI and dealing with those and her new injury and her new world. I was amazed by how well of a job you did with creating a fully rounded character on that.
Thank you.
I mean, it's not really a question. I just wanted to praise you and how well you did with it.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I mean, let me just be clear about this. I wouldn't have been able to do it without the fantastic art of Manuel Prezano, too, who gave so much life and character and just well-roundedness to these girls. So it was definitely teamwork there.
Now, you said you did some research on other individuals who suffered disabilities in preparing for Barbara Gordon. Is there a commonality in the emotions they feel on the occurrence of a disability like that?
I mean, I actually think it's really interesting that you used the phrase "suffers from disability." I think one of the things I know from my own experience, but also from talking to many people, is that adapting to a new way of living, and obviously, like, disabled people are many. I think, if I'm not mistaken, CDC says 1 in 5 Americans is disabled. That's a lot of people. There are a lot of ways to be disabled. There are a lot of ways to deal with disability, find a connection to it or struggle with it. But I think especially when it's an acquired disability, or when you're talking about a sort of progressive illness or something like that, there's a sense of struggle and sometimes a sense of suffering, because it changes not so much who you are, but who you think you can be. And it changes who you are in the eyes of the world, because the world isn't necessarily built in most cases, in many cases, to be accessible to or accepting to disabled people. So there's that first part of learning to deal with that is hard. And it is everything that Babs is going through in the book too. It is that sense of loss and grief and anger at everything around you and needing something to lash out to or at, and just needing something to basically continuously hitting your fist against a brick wall, because it doesn't solve anything, but at that point it makes you feel better. And there's this, I think that's something, definitely not all, but many people who acquire disabilities, or like I said, learn to, like, live with progressive illness, deal with that. I wanted to really focus on that, because it's not something that's often shown. And it's not something that's often shown as a transitional period, because what mattered to me was not just staying with the struggle, but also taking it from struggle to a sense of renewed finding yourself and finding your place in the world and finding who you can be and finding pride in that. And that's like, I would never say I suffer from disability. I live with disability and it informs my life and it informs who I am. And occasionally it sucks a lot. I'm definitely not always fond of it, but it's also a part of my identity and it's something that shapes me and even something I can take pride in.
Now, I think one of the interesting lines that I read in the graphic novel is you said, fear is in the unknown. And mm-hmm. What I like about that quote is that can cover so much ground. There's fear of the unknown about your own future, specifically Barbara Gordon's new future as someone who has a disability, to mm-hmm. fear of the unknown as unknown individual. What we don't know about when someone who is maybe different and is unknown mm-hmm. to us, our instinct is to immediately go to fear first before we go to maybe logic or understanding. First go to fear. And I wonder if you, and also you mentioned fear earlier when we talked about going into that medieval period as well. Mm-hmm. And do you think that is like a core problem that of humans that we do first go to fear, just like Barbara Gordon seemed to first go to fear when she experienced her disability?
Mm-hmm. I think to a great extent, yes. I would say just look at the world as it is now, and especially as this pandemic developed over the last couple of months. I feel like we all had this sense of we don't know what's going to happen and we don't know what the future will hold. And we still don't really know. And there's this it is the unknown aspect of that makes it so terrifying, because that makes it hard to mentally handle, to put a finger on, to figure out how to take this great big thing and place it into a box that we can understand. And I think that that's something that people do in all sorts of cases, whether it's something as gigantic as a pandemic that just uproots our very understanding of what normal means, or whether it is being in a position where you don't know what is expected of you or what normal behavior is, or whether it is meeting someone whom you've never met before, who looks at the world differently, who has different experiences. I think fear is a very common factor in that. And I also think the flip side of that is it's one of the reasons why representation in books matters so much, because it has been scientifically proven over and over again that reading books helps you build empathy and helps you build understanding, and is a fantastic way of not just allowing yourself to be transported and to escape reality for a bit, but also a fantastic way to learn to understand different perspectives and different experiences and different abilities or different cultures or different identities. And that helps us get closer to each other too, because even if your first introduction to someone is through a book, if that hint of the unknown is taken away, it helps us step over that fear more easily.
Yeah, my day job is I'm a high school teacher, and I will say that what you do with and what young adult authors do is so important, because it does introduce students to read. It gives them that connection. It gives a lot of students, and I work at a school with special needs students. Mm-hmm. It gives them someone. Often when you find the right story for them to connect with, to find that commonality. And I think what you're doing with Oracode is really amazing in how you do that. And I also think on some level, you demonstrated that really well with the character of Benjamin as well. Mm-hmm. A character who in the story seems to be afraid to confront his friend now that his friend, at least in his own mind, has changed. So once again, the idea of fear of the unknown, he feared how he would look at maybe his friend. At least that's how I viewed it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that is definitely something I wanted to explore too, because I feel like it's something we do see a lot, especially in disability narratives, and especially looking at things like people don't always know how to deal with someone if they become ill or become disabled. Or there's definitely this sense of it's not part of my usual framework. I don't know what the right things to say are. I don't know what the right things to do are. And speaking about disability specifically, there isn't a lot of positive media representation of disability. There isn't a lot of representation of what it means to be disabled, what normal means when you're disabled, how, like, just the fact that we live our lives as in much the same way most people do. Like, as a slight tangent, it's one of the reasons why I actually really dislike the phrase special needs, because we have the same needs as everyone else does. We want to be loved and seen and understood, and there's nothing special about that, but often it's shown as something that is so outside of what is considered the ordinary, outside of our understanding of the world, that it makes it really hard to connect. And you really have to push through not just that sense of unknown, but also that sense of like the expectations the world places on you, and maybe to this vulnerability of, I don't know how to handle this, and maybe I'll mess up, and maybe I won't say the right things, and maybe for all my best intentions I won't do what I need to do, but I have to try because it's worth it, and because friendship matters more than my own sense of comfort, basically.
Well, I think that's why I think that even the title of your graphic novel is so fantastic, The Oracle Code, because the idea of solving a code to not only unlock her own feelings that she has, unlock potential that she has, but maybe also unlock the code of how to deal with each other. And I think it so many levels that title works in that story. I think that was a wonderful thing about it.
I absolutely agree. I also love seeing how people respond to the title and what they pick out as the thing that needs, like, the code that needs to be cracked. And, like, I definitely agree with what you're saying. But it's interesting to see the different interpretations there.
And I only have a couple more questions. And the first would be the idea of puzzle pieces. Now, there's a lot of allusions to puzzle pieces, not only verbally being spoken, dream sequences, also visually. Was that something that developed as you were writing it? Was that something you immediately wanted to go into when you started writing that, I want to use this as a symbol? And it was something also that you discussed with the artist to include throughout the story in, like, through details throughout?
I mean, a bit of all of those. I knew early on that I wanted the story, like, the sort of, how should I call those? But yeah, those thematic details, I guess, almost. I wanted those to be puzzle-based or code-based, because to me, one of the ways in which I connected to Barbara as a character, like, obviously this is out of continuity, and she's a teenage Barbara Gordon. She's different from who we see in regular continuity. So I needed to find ways to connect with her and still make her feel like an interpretation of the same character. And one of the ways in which I did that was by focusing on her curiosity, her loyalty, but also her desire to solve puzzles, whether that's like physical puzzle pieces or a code that she needs to crack because she's in a hacking competition, or figuring out like her own struggles and her own sense of sometimes shattered sense of identity. But yeah, to me, the puzzle pieces were a good representation of that. And I started off with that quite early on in the script. And then Manuel also just took it and ran with it and created those amazing dream sequences that probably in to some sense also double for dealing with trauma and having those like flashbacks and moments that you keep latching onto, or your brain keeps latching onto. And it really just grew from there. And that was one of the ways in which, like, working with Manuel on this book was just fantastic, because he had such a clear view of these characters, like insight in how they functioned and how to take what I wrote in my script and just make it shine for the graphic novel.
Well, like I said, it was brilliant to look at. The art is absolutely stunning. And let's two last questions. The first being, you do represent hacking as her entranceway back into her feeling, I guess, like herself, maybe.
Yeah.
Is it also intended the symbolism of hacking maybe herself or her feelings, as well as the link to what her previous experience or life was before the before she got injured?
I mean, it's definitely, like, I would say take all the, like, symbolism that you see in it, and, like, I'll tell you, all of it was definitely intentional, even if it wasn't. because occasionally we all have, like, we all have to pretend we know what we're doing. but, good yeah, lesson. No, there's all right, bluffing with confidence. It's a good way to go through life. but yeah, no, there's definitely that sense of I really wanted to have her to have something that didn't change throughout everything that has changed once she gets shot and once she starts using a wheelchair and becomes disabled. I really wanted her to have something that didn't change and would serve as this sort of entry point back into her own sense of self and her own sense of, like, I am still who I was before all of this happened. And I, like, yeah, there's a sense of I've changed, but that's not a bad thing.
Well, I think it was just brilliant how it does bring the entire story together. And once again, I just wanted to praise you on how tight of a story it is. I mean, it's a long story, but within that length, it's so layered. And I do like how it does feel completely entwined within itself. Mm-hmm. Everything felt legit. Everything felt it was earned throughout this story. And I think that was wonderful. And I definitely wanted to ask, is there anything other graphic novels you're working on right now that you can excite your fans with?
I mean, if they haven't picked this up yet, please do. Because launching this book in March of 2020 was slightly terrifying.
I would imagine so. Not the best timing, unfortunately.
No. And then, of course, because I'm me, I also have more things coming out in 2020, because why ever not? but yeah, no, I still have, a book coming out in September, a YA novel called Even If We Break, which is basically One of Us is Lying meets Dungeons and Dragons. It's a group of teens who go to a cabin in the woods to play their homebrew RPG campaign for one last time until most of them go off to college. And then disaster strikes, because I write fun books with angsty storylines. And I'm really excited for that. And then I'm also writing a Goosebumps miniseries, comics. And those will start coming out also in September, so it's going to be a busy month. So yeah, like, I would definitely recommend to all of my fans, please pick up all of these books. They make really good combination, like, combined gifts to people, like, ideally maybe like 100 or 200 of your closest friends. So yeah.
Well, they should, like I said, if they're anything like the Orca Code, I'm sure they're extremely well written. And I really, really appreciate you talking with me about it. Because, like I said, I read it and I thought it, like I said, I thought it was just wonderful how it was done. Visually, even on no matter what level or you're reading it at, it works for you. And I think it can speak to a pretty wide audience.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Like I said, it was teamwork from all of us involved. So I'm really, really glad to hear that the book resonated with you. And thank you so much for having me.
We're back,
and you beat me to it.
I try to. I like to be first. It's fun. You get the intro. I get the back.
Yeah, I like the concept of this graphic novel. I'm excited to read it.
Yeah, it looks really cool. I'm a big fan of these middle reader books they're doing from DC because one, I get burnt out on the super dark DC universe they have. Right, the super dark Batman's got to get beaten up, and it's so
right.
I like the stuff that's like a little. There's serious tones to it, but it's not so not so dark.
You know what I'm getting sick of, dude? Every single person's an asshole. You know what I'm talking about? You get through a story and every single person in the story is some kind of a jerk. And you're just like, Jesus, is everybody's like this.
Yeah, they're super condescending. They always had to make the smart ass joke comments. Like not everybody is like that, all
right? Yeah, right. Well, dude, I just got done watching the first season of Perry Mason on HBO Max. It's amazing. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
It really is amazing. That. But every single character on there is a jerk in some way. And it's just like, God, no one tells a joke. No one laughs. No one has nothing is sunny day at all, ever. It's just brooding, 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 right. You know? And I've just noticed a lot of stuff is like that lately.
Yeah, I know. I like stuff that's a little lighthearted. I was telling my buddy at work today, I was like, I've fallen into like this TikTok hole, right? Where I've been watching a lot of TikTok. And it's like people are like, oh, it's dumb. Like, I mean, yeah, it's dumb, but
that's the whole point.
It's
of
so
it.
Silly, but I like watching it because people are so happy in their TikToks.
Yep. And you can they're dancing, over they're Triller singing. As well. That's the American version of it.
What is it?
Triller.
Oh, I haven't heard of that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah. Snoop Dogg's on it, and there's quite a few people on it.
Oh, nice.
Check it out. I fall into TikTok holes all the time. My favorite new one right now is Gordon Ramsay reviewing all of the people doing their recipes, and it's just like, it's so funny. He's like, oh, my God, no.
What are you doing? No, don't do that.
Always bread side down.
right. No, it's. I like it because, like I said, it just makes you happy because people are so smiling and dancing, and it's like whatever. It makes me smile.
Yeah.
So, but Mary Kay Nightcamp, is that how you said it? She was great. The book looks great. I want to read it. That's all I want to say.
Yeah. And there you go.
I'm sticking to it.
Oh, and before we get off this podcast, Robert, you're so wrong on Man of Steel. Henry Cavill's version, and it's not Henry Cavill because he's great, but the people who wrote him and the direction that he had, I don't care if he loves that guy or not, is not the definitive by a long shot. And I like those movies.
It's not the quintessential Superman.
I enjoyed BVS. I mean, me and Johnny had arguments about it quite a few times because I liked it. I still like it. But let's get the facts straight. You know what I mean? You said Quentin Superman. You didn't deviate from movie or comic. There's no way that any other Superman. Actually, the only other Superman that could say is the definitive Superman is the comic strip out of the newspaper that the original creators actually did for how long? They did for like 20 years, right?
They did for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be your definitive Superman. After that,
it's
the comic book because the amount of, one, it's historic. Two, 2,000 years from now, they will not be talking about Man of Steel, the movie, or Batman versus Superman, or the Justice League movie. They will not. But they will continue to talk and to teach about DC's Superman and the writings thereof. Matter of fact, they'll probably still be writing Superman in a comic book form. So that is the quintessential, because you cannot debate it. There's no debate. So I've been thinking about it.
The quintessential Superman is a comic book Superman, and it's like, you can turn it up from there, but I'm actually planning to write an article in response to that to Robert.
am I right or am I wrong? In 2,000 years, what's going to be remembered?
Superman as a whole, of who what the character is, which is going to be the comic book version, not the movie versions.
And if there is a movie version,
it's going to be remembered in 1,000 years, 100 years, whatever from now. It's going to be Christopher Reeves one.
Yeah, because it was really the birth of the superhero movie.
It is, and his portrayal of the character personified the comics. Even though they changed things, they changed a lot. They changed all
they
of Krypton.
Change
they changed
any of the spirit though.
But the concept of who Clark and Kal-El and Superman are was nailed in his performance. Yeah. So there you go, Robert. Let's wrap it up and come back to that one.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed listening to Mariki. Oh, my God. I am so sorry. I am butchering her name, and I feel horrid. But if you love that interview with Jeff, and go out there and get the Oracle Code. I think you're really, really going to enjoy it. There's more interviews just like that at spoilerverse.com. Go check out our back issues.
Yep, so many of our back issues of all of our other podcasts. And as I've told you for several days in a row now, we've got a website redesign, which is going to be pretty awesome when it launches. I'm super excited for it. We're about 2, maybe 3 weeks away from that happening. Hopefully by early September, we can have that out for you. It's going to be pretty cool. We also have articles and reviews and previews up there from all of our writers. We got the K-Files and Roach's Den, so much fun stuff. And we have a store link. Go to the store link and you can pick up a t-shirt, a hoodie, or a face mask, or a sticker, or whatever. And as I always say, you can look fly as hell and get all those glorious employees you want and, you know, help support the show a little bit and, you know, help us pay those bills, keep those lights on.
In an oceans of podcasts, we are Cthulhu.
That's
Cthulhu compelled you to do.
We open the
Henry. I almost said open more. The door.
You were on autopilot there because I was talking.
I know. I was waiting for you to go, and then I was like, as soon as you're done, I'm like, I'm gonna just go in at it because it'll make right. him go what?
Because I was like, open the door. Nope, not open the door. Open the mind. All right.
That was good. All right, man.
And see.